Thank you for joining us live on the air.
My pleasure.
One Nation under God has turned into one nation under the influence of one drug. Television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV, its satellite links are United States of unconsciousness. Apathetic, therapeutic, and extremely addictive. The methadone metronome, pumping out 150 channels 24 hours a day. You can flip through all of them, and still there's nothing worth watching. TV is a reason why less than 10% of our nation reads books daily. Why most people think Central America means Kansas. Socialism means un-American, and apartheid is the new headache remedy. Absorbed in its world, it's so hard to find us. It shapes our minds the most. Maybe the mother of our nation should remind us that we're sitting too close to the television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV is a stomping ground for political candidates, where bears in the woods are chased by Grecian formed bald eagles. TV is mechanized politics, remote control over the masses, co-sponsored by environmentally safe gases. Watch for the PBS special. It's a perpetuation of the two-party system, where image takes precedence over wisdom, where soundbite politics are served to the fast food culture, where straight teeth in your mouth are more important than the words that come out of it. Race baiting is the way to get selected. Will he Horton or will he not get elected? On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation.
On the screen is an address where you can mail your tithe offering or gift of love.
Okay, got the idea? All right, now let's concentrate.
Better living through television.
TV, is it the reflector or the director? Does it imitate us or do we imitate it? Because a child watches 1,500 murders before he's 12 years old. And then we wonder why we created a Jason generation that learns to laugh rather than abhor the horror. TV is a place where armchair generals and quarterbacks can experience firsthand the excitement of video warfare as the theme song is sung in the background. Sugar-sweet sitcoms that leave us with a bad actor taste, while pop stars metamorphosize into soda pop stars. You saw the video, you heard the soundtrack. Well, now go buy the soft drink. Well, the only cola that I support would be a Union COLA cost of living allowance. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. Back again, new and improved, we return to our irregularly programmed schedule, hidden cleverly between heavy-breasted beer and car commercials. CNN, ESPN, ABC, BCB, TNT, but mostly BS, where oxymoronic language like virtually spotless, fresh, frozen, light, yet filling, and military intelligence have become standard. TV is a place where phrases are redefined, like recession to necessary downturn, crude oil on a beach to moose, civilian death to collateral damages, and being killed by your own army is now called friendly fire. TV is a place where the pursuit of happiness has become the pursuit of trivia, where toothpaste and cars have become sex objects, where imagination is sucked out of children by a cathode ray nipple. TV is the only wet nurse that would create a cripple. Television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance, feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation.
And that white noise is the end of the Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy song. Television, the drug of the nation. So we got some great music lined up, but I don't know if we have time to get to it. That was that. But we're in the middle of this article here. Yeah, 7 in 10 UK workers, United Kingdom, British workers are chronically broke, study finds. And we're just getting into that because we want to show the problems of capitalism are not confined to the massive inequalities and lowering living standards in the United States, of course. They are international, but also not just in the underdeveloped world, but also in other industrialized capitalist economies, you know, like wealthy, quote-unquote, economies. Although, as you'll see, the wealth is in the hands of the few, not the many. So we have, and this also will give you an idea why Corbyn is so popular over there in Britain, because he takes on some of these issues. So they have this same article here, again, from The Guardian. Amelia Hill, January 25th, 2018. A report that used as its sort of hook a new class structure in Britain. And class is in quotes, because it's not really class, but they let's say category. And they broke it down. I got to read some of these. It's one, the chronically precarious. And it says, these are the reliably broke. People in this group are typically on a steady contract. This is a thing in Britain, a sort of work contract thing. Albeit with low pay. 60% have less than £1,000 saved, and they have low job satisfaction, little autonomy at work. So a typical job in this category would be a sales assistant. So we would call that retail. The acutely precarious. Usually broke, but with significant income yo-yoing. Work is often low paid, but unlike the chronically precarious irregular, this is a group, it's a young group, and 45% have a degree, a college degree. Typical job, 0 hours hospitality. So that means you're in the hotel industry or whatever. And by 0 hours, they mean you're not guaranteed any hours. See, this is a thing happening in the United States in retail and other sectors where they change your schedule every week. So you can't plan, you can't go get another job, you're just really screwed really badly. It's becoming more use. There are places where they're trying to actually fight it legislatively and say you can't do this in this area. And then you hear in the United States, in Britain it's more widespread, or I think it is, where you have what they call 0 hours contracts, which means you might not have some hours next week. You might have some hours next week. You're not guaranteed hours.
No, that's bad.
Horrible.
That is. I thought that was done over with over there.
Nope. It's a huge, huge problem.
What about the
including here, actually, but
was
getting
that a
worse.
New phenomenon, right? During the
it's relatively
Thatcher,
new. Yeah, I think it started then or beyond that. Yeah. And then you have the flexi workers. This is after the acutely precarious. The third category is the flexi workers. They love their job, even if it doesn't pay well. Yeah, they must be Americans. They love their job, even if it doesn't pay well. 83% are satisfied at work. But
sure, boss, right away, boss.
Bootlicker. I'm a bootlicker. 59% earn less than £21,000 a year. How can you love your job if you earn less than that? High levels of savings. Many are redundant second careers. They value autonomy above security. Typical job, freelance photographer. Oh, click those pictures. Anyway, the steady staters. They feel well-treated, 90%, and well-paid, 69%.
Was it called steady what?
Steady staters. So you're going to see they're kind of caught not going anywhere, but they think things are okay. Even if work is a means to an end, but they have low savings and rely on work for income, so they are vulnerable to any kind of shock, like a layoff or whatever. Their routine jobs are at high risk of automation, so a typical job is a public sector administrator. Whatever that means. What's a public sector administrator? Like working for probably the government, right? Public sector.
Works,
yeah, it's the government.
Like
yeah,
that, right.
Yeah, so they're like in the welfare office or something, or what they would call benefits office. And then when there's a cut or something, they're going to lose their job. Yeah, okay. The idealists, mid-earning, passionate, and often millennials, 50% under 35, 70% think they make a positive contribution to society at work. They are most likely to rely on others, such as parents, for income. Oops. They are urbane, and 25% have more than £10,000 saved. Typical job, charity employee. That's such a contradiction right there. They're part of
so
the.
So they're working for an NGO.
Yeah, yeah. Charity won't set us free, but it's given them a you know, better than average earning. It looks like, but
did I tell you when I went,
they still don't make enough to be on their own. They rely on their parents for income.
A couple years ago, I was job hunting, and I seen this activist thing job, and I actually got in. You know. And when I went there, I seen that there were Democrats, and I started saying, well, I'm a socialist. And in one of the interviews, one of the guys was like, yeah, I'm with him.
Ah, yeah. Nice.
We both walked out of there because what they wanted us to do is to work from morning, literally go out and just leaflet and talk about our causes and blah, 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 and you know,
raise
all this
money.
Stuff. And raise money.
Yeah, yeah.
$10 an hour.
Yep.
Doing that.
Yep.
I said, but
it's really hard work. People burn out.
And the minute I said socialist, yeah. You know, they just—I was like the
pariah.
The pariah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But at least one guy agreed with me on certain things, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah.
And he got influenced. Just like, you know what? Yeah, I'm with him. Let's get out of here. You know,
yeah.
What I mean? Walked out of that place.
I know a certain number of people just from my own, you know, circle of friends and acquaintances who went through the same thing you did.
Yeah.
They were unemployed. They were kind of desperate, and they went to these kind
and
of jobs.
Said, let me go check this out. Who knows if they're, you know, at my level.
Yeah.
But they weren't on my level.
Yeah.
Then I said socialism. They were like, oh, the pariah here, you know. Oh, my God. He's going to affect the whole, you know.
Especially when you're younger, you can really get sucked into those, like, mass. They used to be mass purge. I don't know if that's
and
still exists,
heavy
but stuff
liberal,
like that.
Liberal.
Oh, yeah, totally. It's in, yeah, it's NGO
right liberal,
world.
Not even left liberal.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, like, right.
Yeah, it's all about
just
raising the money.
Conservative as, you know, like the, you know. The Tea Party, you know.
Yeah, it's all about raising the money. That's all it's
exactly.
about.
It's about
a corporate
the
quota.
Thing. Oh, yeah. And they gave you a quota. They literally say, "This is if you make this much, you can go and then you got to hit that quota."
And if you don't,
I'm like,
you're out.
Yeah, Lord forbid, right?
I know somebody.
Meanwhile,
that,
I get smacked around because somebody didn't agree with me on the street, right?
Yeah, I know somebody that did that seriously. Thought, you know, here's
not
my
that
this,
I agree
this is
with
gonna
the
be
stuff they were trying to, you know.
Yeah. No, but I know somebody that did this seriously. They thought this was going to be like a real job. And they tried hard at it. They couldn't make the quota, and they got fired.
No.
Anyway, the strivers, these have regular jobs with high income and high savings, but worry the link between hard work and fair pay is broken. No kidding. 73% are stressed. It never was there, really. 73% are stressed, but only 20% think their pay reflects their efforts. Typical job, middle manager. There you go. The cops for the
cops,
bosses, the higher bosses.
They're the thugs.
Yeah, the high flyers. The wealthiest group, 55%, have more than $10,000 in savings. They're successful in adapting to automation and the most likely group to value new technology. They report high job security, high autonomy, and high fulfillment. Typical job, director of an IT services business. So that is probably like
CEO status.
1%. So then it ends with saying there are nearly 1 million people, that's what we were talking about a minute ago, on zero-hour contracts, nearly 1 million. That means you're working in a place, but they won't tell you what your schedule is for the next week, and it could include work or no work. 1.7 million in temporary work. A record 4.8 million are self-employed, while there are an estimated 1.1 million people in Britain's gig economy, which in just 5 years will equal the number of workers in the National Health Service in England. Anyway, I don't have time to read all of it.
There's a lot of hustlers out there.
Oh, yeah.
I've noticed that when I went to London.
Uber,
once.
Lyft, Uber. Yeah.
I've seen a lot of this. You ever seen that?
Oh, the card three card thing. Monty, yeah.
And then
yeah.
when they see the authorities, I said, oh my God, you know.
But you want to talk about your taxes because you got a rude awakening this year, right?
Rude awakening. Well, how you figure, right? Last year I did 23,000. This year, you know, and I got some money back. So
right.
This year I think think it's earned 19,692 or federal AGI, which I don't even know what that stands for.
I don't either. But you got to pay. You told me you have to pay this time, right?
Taxable income, 9,000, close to 10,000, 9,884. A refund due, negative 20, because I owe the state.
So you're going to pay them 20?
For not having an income. This is a penalty. A penalty.
Man.
And
last year you had a penalty of 600, right?
On the federal level.
Yeah.
Automatically.
Yeah.
So I was supposed to get 1,100. I got 500.
It's horrible.
So right off the bat, boom.
Yeah. Yeah, we're still doing our taxes. We're going to get less than last year.
State, 21.
Less back.
$21 negative because I owe them. So it's $41 in total and needs to be in the account by April 15th.
Where's the other 21? What's that for?
Oh, it's 41 because it's 20 for the state,
yeah.
And 21 for the federal.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. That's horrible. You should have to pay anything. Yeah. And by the way, when you hear, we were talking about this off air, but when you hear on the corporate media that all these people that don't make a lot of money are paying, are not paying taxes, first of all, it's bull.
What? Yeah. Rewind that one.
You don't hear that? I hear that all the time.
Say that again.
They're saying that only rich people or relatively wealthy people pay income taxes. And technically, well, first of all, that's just untrue. But there is a certain number of people that don't pay income taxes. But often that phrase is not thrown in there, income. They just say taxes. When every working person knows you pay a crap load of taxes through Social Security and all that other stuff that comes out of your paycheck. And payroll taxes are killer.
So I'm on a 15% tax bracket, so I'm still paying. So
yeah. if you're paying, I don't make enough.
Supposedly, because my mother said that, Trump said that anybody who makes $25,000 and up or less than $25,000 doesn't get any income back, which was my case today.
And you had to pay some, too.
Okay. But still.
41.
I'm still paying.
I know, that's what I mean. Yeah,
but what horrible. But what I'm trying to say is like, well, if I'm not making that much, then don't tax me. In
course,
the first place,
course,
right? That would be a just society.
But guess what?
But obviously we're not under a just
society. Then you're
still
paying taxes, though. This is my point.
Mm-hmm.
From your payroll taxes. The taxes you pay come out of your check every week. Check out your pay stub.
Exactly.
See a crap load of taxes come out. State, federal, FICA, blah, exactly. blah, 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 blah.
Exactly.
Then we go buy stuff, and they got I had to go to Burger King yesterday. I hadn't eaten anything. I was starving. I had to go grocery shopping. Never go grocery shopping on an empty stomach. I learned that a long time ago, right? So I go, I got to get some food in me. What's the cheapest place that I can stomach? Burger King. I actually like Burger King somewhat. So I go to Burger King, right? And I'm shoving down some not very good food. And I had a fish sandwich and cheesy tots. They had this new cheesy tots thing. They were pretty good, actually. But anyway, so here I am. I looked down at my slip. And a bunch of that cost of that meal, which was cheap but still too much, I shouldn't have paid anything. 7%, should have bought it all.
Right?
It has huge frickin' in Europe they call it VAT, value added tax. Here, sales tax. Sales tax is a killer for us. It kills us. So anytime you hear a corporate media person say most working people don't pay any taxes, you're allowed to go for the jugular, man. Grab them by the throat, throw them on the ground. Stomp on them because it's a freaking lie that hurts everybody. We pay so much in taxes in this country, it's freaking ridiculous.
When I went to the Azores, I went to a cafe. And over there, people are very open, you know, and stuff like that. It's the businesses that take the hit of the taxes, not the individual consumer.
Not here.
So the lady showed me, you know, that beer I just sold you for 90 cents, it was a. You know, they got a little 10 ounce as opposed to 12 ounce,
okay.
But still, 90 cents, all right? Not a euro, but close to a euro. Some places a euro. They pay 25 cents out of it in taxes. They only make about 50 cents out of, you know.
Yeah, they sell a lot of beer, though. It adds up.
25 cents for the cost to buy it in the first place.
Yeah.
So I said, so you guys, that's why, you know, it's only 6 euros, it's flat, there's no taxes in
there. Yeah, but you know, small business kind of will give you the same song and dance. I don't believe it. I don't believe it because what you know, they often exaggerate taxes, what they pay workers. I had someone that owned a small business say that, we hate hiring people. He had a partner, so there were two of them that owned it. We hate hiring people because they just bleed you dry, you know? Not understanding that they create more value, you know? And they just didn't want to go through a period of expansion, basically. and they were getting a break from their landlord, you know. They were, I don't know what their tax situation was, but I don't think it was that bad. I mean, if you really, see, what the businesses don't do, even the small ones, they don't open the books, man. They don't show you really what's going on. Now, she showed you that, that person showed you that tax thing.
Well, it's a different culture.
But there's a lot of other stuff going
different
on.
Different culture. I was wondering, there's no taxes here because we're so used to it, right?
But they might get,
where it's like, they, no, we it's part of the, it's already in the price.
You but they might I mean? Get, we they, take they the might hit. Have gotten a tax break or a subsidy of some sort from the state to open up too, though. You know, there's a lot of,
yeah.
A lot of,
a lot of social stuff I don't, going
see,
on.
See, with
there.
Businesses, as we've talked about on the show, it's like, they don't just go out of business when they're broke. That actually rarely happens. Businesses usually see that their rate of profit is falling and they see some other place where they want to go and make more money doing that, and they'll shut something down, whether it's a big factory or whether it's a small business. That happens a lot. They usually don't wait till the last second. There are examples, of course, of like, you know, all of a sudden the store is shuttered up and that's it, you know, see you later. But it's usually like they're moving their capital around and they're moving their money around to where they can make the most money. And that doesn't mean they're not making any money in other things. It's not the most money. They want to go where they make the most money. So I just don't see them staying in business if things are as bad as they say. You know, even small businesses.
You're talking about the one in the Azores?
Sure, I guess. I don't know. Maybe it's an exception.
She wasn't saying that, I'm going bankrupt. She's just saying, oh, this is because I was just curious. I was like, you guys don't tax. I'm just wondering. As a socialist, I'm just wondering.
Yeah, they don't tip either. And no tips either.
Yeah. That's that. Yeah. When I tipped and she's like, gave it back to me. I was like, no. It's like, okay. So I guess it's two different mind frames. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, as someone coming from the United States used to tipping.
There's differences, but the difference
over there is not even a standard. It's like, what is that?
Yeah, it depends. And things change over there, too. You know, they get more Americanized and stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Anyway, by the way, a couple quick facts on student debt since we were throwing a lot of facts today. This is a study by the Sanders Institute, sandersinstitute.com. I like how they say today at 11:17 a.m. What is today? I don't know what date that was. All right, I guess it was 2/6. This one I printed out at least. February 6, 2018. It's about student debt. And they say that if you cancel student debt, now they say one-time cancellation, which I don't like, but they say all these great things would happen to the economy if you did that. But I'm not going to get into that right away. I'm not going to get into that all. I don't have time. I'm just going to say, give you the statistics about what's happening right now. More than 44 million Americans, that's a big chunk, are caught in a student debt trap. Collectively, they owe nearly $1.4 trillion in outstanding student loan debt. And this holds back everything from people buying houses, getting married, having children. And basically they come to this idea that nothing's going to mitigate this, nothing's going to help this except a debt cancellation. But then you read a little deeper, they say one-time debt cancellation. Anyway, speaking of youth and so on, got some stuff on millennials here. Did you want to say more about taxes, though, before we go out? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump away from that. You're getting screwed as a lot of other people are. Yeah. And all that Trump stuff, you know, I don't have that all researched, but
if I said any more, I'll have an out of body experience. my soul just like,
well, a lot of the way the Trump stuff goes is that the poorest are getting increased taxes. That's why people were outraged by it. Whether it ended up there or not, I don't know. So watch out for next year. I have to pay more.
What do you mean? If I make more money, where I'm going to be?
Oh, that way, yeah. But I mean, just in general, I mean, the latest I heard about the Trump stuff, and it could have changed, is that it's this oddly backward thing. A lot of taxes in America are regressive, and the whole thing is regressive, but it hurts the poorest the worst. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're going to pay percentages bigger than the richest.
It's like when I asked the lady, well, didn't he got rid of that, you know, penalization thing? Oh, no, that kicks in next year.
Well, if it's the health...
You're lucky that you didn't pay $1,000 like my last client.
The health care?
I
think she means for the state. I think Massachusetts as a state is going to have a... And I have to double check this, but I think they're going to have a... they're going to charge people the way the federal government used to if you don't go take one of their insurance plans. Mm-hmm. But I'll have to double check on that. Hey, you know, we have a new issue of the newspaper, Socialist Alternative. We really urge you to get a subscription. We are doing a subscription drive now in Socialist Alternative, so you could you know, really support independent media, help Socialist Alternative increase its frequency. Basically, right now we come out 10 times a year, every month except for holiday. And there's a subscription drive going on. Go to socialistalternative.org for more information. And we are, again, the organization that helped get elect the first socialist Seattle City Council 100 years and win the first citywide $50 minimum wage in 2014 in Seattle. And a lot of other stuff we're working on and worked on. This is a thing I've read before on the air, a column called Why I'm a Socialist each month. I've only seen 1 month skipped on this. Usually every issue of Socialist Alternative has someone testify, writing their own article about why they became a socialist, or why they are a socialist. So Why I'm a Socialist this month, February, Socialist Alternative's newspaper, Socialist Alternative. Alicia Morales from Boston, close to here, said the following, and I'll read probably parts of it, but anyway, it's a really good one. She wrote, being born and raised in a working class family, I always noticed inequality, but I didn't start really questioning or challenging until a few years back when Bernie Sanders was running in the primaries. I was as apolitical as everyone else in my little hometown of Webster, Mass. Where's Webster? Do you know?
I think that's out west.
I'm thinking west, too. But where?
Because I never heard, like going towards Worcester, a little further out.
I don't know. I think maybe around Worcester,
you know,
huh?
Fitchburg, yep, area?
Yeah. Okay, so Webster, Mass. We'll have to
or
look it up later.
Or maybe even south. It could be, like, right around Brockton or Randolph area.
Yeah, I have no idea, unfortunately. I don't know my local geography well enough, but I wish I've driven through it.
He would pull out his Star Trek phone.
Yeah. We need the smartphone. I remember blindly believing that a $50 minimum wage was unnecessary for unskilled workers, that it would cause inflation, just like Fox News said.
Whoa, rewind that one.
What?
She said, I remember.
This is when she was apolitical.
That 15
apolitical
wage was unnecessary.
Youth in Webster, Mass. She believed that, blindly believed, she says, that a $50 minimum dollar wage was unnecessary for unskilled workers and that it would cause inflation, like Fox News said.
So it's unnecessary to have workers, period, creating.
I've heard that
value
argument a million times from brainwashed people and from the corporate media. Although
we don't need workers, it gets done by itself.
Don't worry. Fallen off. That cut, like I could tell you in Worcester, 3 years ago, I had to argue with workers about 15, and now not so much. It's becoming more accepted. Mm-hmm. The more it gets out there in certain cities and certain states, and Massachusetts has a referendum for this fall on $15 minimum wage. Now it's got big holes in it. Unfortunately, we would have done it a lot better if we had written it and fought, you know, but we're supporting it. Warts and all. So then she says, this is Alicia Morales, Why I'm a Socialist. I understood that the state of poverty I was in was due to my parents' lack of an education, and to get out of it, I would have to pull myself up by my bootstraps. I moved out, worked two jobs throughout high school, and after a year of deferring and saving money, I was finally ready to move to Boston to start college. I started off sharing a living room with two other girls in an overpriced, dumpy apartment complex on the 12th floor. Comparing this life to how far I've come, I felt like hard work really does pay off and that it's possible for anyone to get to where they want to be in life. But I quickly realized this was the wrong way to look at the, quote, American dream, unquote. In my own experience as a worker at a big pharmacy, I came to the revelation that management is more than okay with paying people starvation wages to boost profits. So it sounds like she maybe worked at CVS or something, right? You used to work at Rite Aid, right? Where'd you work,
Brooks, when I first got hired. Did you hear the emergement?
Yeah, with who?
Walgreens. Bought them out.
Yeah. Even when I got a promotion, the daily sales of the store I worked at matched my annual salary. Now, that might sound extreme to people. Let me repeat that. Even when I got a promotion, the daily sales of the store I worked at matched my annual salary. That's amazing, but guess what? It's very common. I used to work at a movie theater. On a good Saturday night, they made more money than I did my whole year. You know what I mean? This happens in a lot of low wage jobs. And even the higher wage jobs. I wonder what you know, Harvard makes in a year.
Remember the cartoon with Scrooge?
Yeah.
This is my money. That's you. Right there. Right in the bottom.
Oh, yeah. I didn't have to skip meals to pay bills anymore, but there are still families surviving on less than I earn to make ends meet. The 2016 election really changed my perception completely. When the DNC, Democratic National Committee, rigged the primaries and allowed for Trump's win, I lost all faith in the two-party system. We were told at my liberal arts college that Trump could never win, and while students were sulky in their depression the day after the results of the election, I was prepared to fight. Socialist Alternative put on an emergency rally that night in which 10,000 people attended. That was in Boston. Amidst the hopelessness and anger, I felt this protest motivated me to keep fighting, and I haven't stopped since. I joined SA within the next month, and I started linking worker struggles and the current political climate to the instabilities of the capitalist system. This fight is not just about race, class, and anything else capitalists serve to divide us by. It is about dismantling and replacing this system with a more sustainable and just one that Socialist Alternative calls for. So I thought that was really good. Really like that. There's some other really good articles in the paper. We don't have time to get into. There's a large page, big page on the Me Too movement, the end harassment at work and so on movement. Puerto Rico disaster continues. A review of that book that came out a couple weeks ago, Fire and Fury, about the inside maneuvers and machinations of the Trump administration. And then a centerfold, The Poor People's Campaign at 50, The Radical Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., written by Algier Hawkins. And this is a very smart article. It goes into some history that you probably don't know about, how radical, how far-reaching and progressive that movement was, and the fact that there's an attempt right now to have a Poor People's Campaign resurrected by, what's the name of the guy, Barber? Yeah, William J. Barber. The guy that led the North Carolina Moral Mondays movement has called for a 2018 version of the Poor People's Campaign. They're starting to have meetings around the country. We actually are involved in a lot of those meetings, but it's hard to say whether this campaign will really take off. And as Algier says at the end of the article, he says, it's hard to say at this point whether the new Poor People's Campaign will truly take off. But its organizers are pointing in the right direction towards the need for a new multiracial movement of working people, the poor, and the most oppressed. Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2016 also raised the need for a massive redirection of size resources to poverty. But we will need to go further and create a new political party based on the interests of working people and the poor, which could challenge the entire capitalist establishment, which is complicit in creating the conditions we see today. As Dr. King powerfully exclaimed, quote, oppressed people cannot remain oppressed forever.
Hey, Jeff, there's a little thing, U.S. and North Korea here on the false alarm in Hawaii and the
nuclear war. Yeah, who wrote that one?
Kimmerle, Seattle. And it says right here, North Korea and South Korea agreed to a combined Olympics delegation. Not like the right wing stuff I was hearing that they were drumming up war, you know.
Well, you had asked me about what was I thinking about the Olympics, and to tell you the truth, I'm not thinking about it at all. Are you watching it? Winter
Is
Olympics.
Is it out yet already?
Started, yeah. I think it's started.
No, I haven't watched it. I was just hearing about it.
I heard about some of the stuff you're talking about, that they had a sort of like, some connections between the two Cuban regimes that people are saying is a hopeful step or whatever. And they're concluding the Trump administration doesn't like that at all. And that's probably a fair conclusion. Since Trump is saber rattling all the time, and this is more about the two Korean regimes talking, at least. It's interesting to have a whole. I didn't read the article yet, but I should have. The whole thing, Korean unification is a big deal in Korea. It used to be a big deal from sort of a leftist standpoint. I think now it's a big deal in general, but. There are vested capitalist interests in South Korea that want to, demonize the North, just like here. And the North is not socialist at all. If you actually research into it, they abandoned any kind of pretense at socialism a long time ago. But they still have a heavy state, control over the economy. A lot of people don't realize this. They also have in the North sort of these free enterprise zones, quote unquote, or places where they provide the cheap labor and the multinationals go in and exploit that cheap labor and the lack of regulations and so on. So the North isn't quite as isolated and so on and so on as people indicate in the corporate media, and it's ripe pickings economically for much more powerful, subsidized by the U.S. historically government in South Korea. So a reunification of Korea could be a really harsh thing, actually, for Korean workers, mostly north, but also even in the south. I'm not arguing for it to not be, unified. That would be probably a step in the right direction for socialism in
like
some
East
ways.
East and West Germany when they broke the wall? And
Worse. Because East German workers have never, they still complain about lower living standards. But this, I think, would be even worse. I think it would be vicious, kind of. And so I don't think it's just like the crazy ruler of North Korea, et cetera, if he is crazy, holding back this process. I think it's a general kind of feeling like this could not, there's many ways this could not work. And that kind of is a kind of mood there, I would predict. Don't know for sure. I'm sure some North Koreans probably buy the propaganda if the South took over. They'd immediately have a higher standard of living and so on. I wouldn't be so fast to say that.
I don't think the North Virginia would let that happen. Like, they wouldn't.
Well,
I'm
not so sure about that. The Stalinists in many other parts of the world gave it up without a fight.
No, I mean, but the military, don't you think they would fight the
They're
South?
They're not even Stalinists
the South
anymore,
even
by the way.
Started attacking them? Like,
I'm not saying a takeover would have to be through an attack.
Okay.
Yeah, it could be just a,
because that would be, short of war. Like, dude.
Well, look what happened with Russia and Eastern Europe. These are Stalinist regimes. We don't support them. We didn't support them. But they did have bureaucratically planned economies and not a market, not a capitalist system. They gave up and went over to capitalism without an invasion, without any serious pressure. Now, in rewriting history, some of the Stalinists claim, well, having to keep up with the military spending was really difficult. Yeah, okay, but that's not enough to explain an abandonment of your Stalinist system, and I'm just thinking out loud of sort of scenarios in Korea where they could reunify, and that would seem to be a good thing because the unification, the split of the country was done by U.S. imperialism primarily, the UN and so on. So that would sound like a good thing on the surface, but I'm just afraid that the North Koreans would be used as extra cheap labor, and maybe cannon fodder for some sort of war as well.
Just like Vietnam.
Yeah,
cheaper labor than
exactly.
China. That's why they're going to Vietnam. And now, we got them even more cheaper.
But Vietnam still keeps the trappings of Stalinism. In this case, probably the South would dominate and would just have liberal, so-called democracy. But on the other hand, the U.S., the Trump administration supposedly is just, into saber rattling and not into this any kind of negotiations happening on that level. The Korean people themselves negotiating, so to speak, or the regimes at least. So I don't know. It's an interesting situation. I should read that article. This article I mentioned about the Poor People's Campaign, I just want to say one thing about it real quickly. So the Poor People's, quote, the Poor People's Campaign, by Elgier Hawkins, latest issue of Social Alternative, quote, the Poor People's Campaign would eventually create a rift in the student SCLC. What does SCLC stand for? I forgot. Student court. I used to know that. Student. Anyway, don't have time to find that. SCLC, with many of the leading activists seeing themselves as organizers for black people exclusively and not the wider working class and poor. The plan was to organize a mass march on April 22nd, 1968, culminating in a permanent tent encampment in Washington, D.C., called Resurrection City until their demands were met. The title of the encampment was a religious reference to the resurrection of Christ, serving as a testimony of the resurrection of human beings. These demands included, this is the part I really wanted to get to. Now, this never happened, but you can see the kind of demands that were coming out of the movement at the time, even not the most healthy end of the movement. They include a $30 billion annual appropriation to fight poverty. That would be $213 billion today. This is at the height of the post-war upswing, 1968. Congressional passage of full employment, which, by the way, happened. Did you know that? That the Congress one time passed a bill, I think it was in the 70s or 80s, for full employment?
No.
They just didn't fund it. It just became useless.
Well, it got passed, so it's just
but
like
no funding, no program,
funding.
Just a useless piece of paper. Guaranteed annual wage. They don't give a figure. Construction of 500,000 low-cost housing units to eliminate slums. Petition the government to pass an economic bill of rights. Anyway, I just wanted to get into that a little bit. There's a lot of other really good stuff in the article. And then finishing up
with... So we would
have
a vibrant economy had that been realized.
I don't know about that, but we would have had some significant reforms that I think would have taken a lot more than the move. See, what the point that Algeria was just making is that was from a section of the movement that was moving away from multiracial struggle into just sort of black nationalism. They wouldn't have the power to get those demands, unfortunately. And it would take a broader movement. And it would have to be electoral, too, probably. You know, so that's the whole thing. I mean, looking back at the Poor People's Campaign at that time, the ties to the Democratic Party were very unhealthy. And the Democratic Party was able to keep a lid on things. That's part of what was going on then. But you had individuals like King himself, Martin Luther King himself, moving to the left, getting radicalized, questioning those ties. If things had continued, if they hadn't murdered Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and so on, I think that there would have been sort of a push for back towards multiracial struggle and towards some sort of new party. Because Malcolm X hated the Democratic Party. King, I think, was moving away from that. Here's that article you said, False Alarm in Hawaii, Nuclear War. Catalonia.
Malcolm X,
DACA.
I remember him saying once that, you know, he had more respect for the Republicans because at least they told you right in your face, you know what I mean?
Yep.
As opposed to the Democrats.
Yep.
They smile in your face and backstab you in the back.
Well, speaking of the Democrats, I mean, there's a general sort of outline of what's coming up that is probably most likely true, that the election's happening later this year and probably even over to 2020, the lesser evilism mood is going to be huge. You know, it always is, but it's going to be even worse than normal. And the Democrats are going to just pull out all the stops like they are now, like they did at the Women's March, to just say, don't protest, don't do this, don't do that, just vote Democrat. You know, run for office, vote Democrat. Run for office as a Democrat, vote Democrat. And with the way Trump is, it's likely that that argument will resonate somewhat with people, right? Question is, and it is an open question to a certain extent, how deep is that really going to go? Even at a time where it looks like everything is lined up for lesser evilism, things are happening that people are seeing through the Democratic Party even now. And part of what they're seeing is the Democratic Party just is not a vehicle for real, any kind of, even the best vehicle for fighting the Republicans, much less a vehicle for fundamental change. So, for example, today I heard a speech, recent speech by Jill Stein from the Green Party, who reminded me, and I've read this before and heard it before, that prior to Trump's tax bill, Chuck Schumer had said what he wanted to get done in Congress this year or last year was a corporate tax decrease, a cut in the corporate tax, which of course Trump did totally. Now, Schumer and the rest of the Democrats voted against the tax bill, but I heard some of them saying it wasn't because of the corporate tax increase, which is, of course, the worst thing about it. I mean, everything's bad about it, but that was really horrible. So they had that in common with the Republicans. They didn't really fight. Also, they didn't fight the tax bill or anything else, DACA, the tax, whatever, in terms of mobilizing a mass movement. We talked about that on the show before. But if you're an American and you're looking around for somewhere to politically, at a mass scale, fight back against the Trump administration, the Democrats aren't providing that. They're saying a very passive thing. Wait till the elections and vote for us. Or maybe a few of you run for office. The proactive thing would be a party, like a workers' party might do in another country, mobilize street protests, try to get a mass movement going, try to bring Trump down through political pressure. You know, that happens a lot in other countries. Doesn't happen here, because the Democratic Party has a symbiotic relationship with the Republican Party. They are both corporate political parties. They both agree on fundamentals about imperialism, about the economy, and so on. They have differences, different approaches, different personalities. The Democrats get a big pass right now from a lot of people because they don't see any Democrat as crazy as Trump. That's all there. But there's also the other reality of the historically symbiotic relationship between the two corporate parties, where they unite for wars, for repression, and where they have fundamentally the same economic programs and plans and implement them, sometimes even together, nationally, but especially locally, you know? But anyway, as far as DACA goes, what I'm leading up to is that DACA has shown a lot of people, again, especially younger people that haven't gone through this stuff before, that lesser evilism doesn't work. Democrats are not really fighting, you know? Pelosi gave an eight-hour speech for DACA, but privately, she said, vote your conscience to the other Democrats. She didn't say vote against DACA. She didn't try to do any sort of party discipline among the Democratic Party office holders in Congress. And that was, and so there's, they have this rhetoric, but the reality is often very, very different. And even the rhetoric is often very different from the perception of the Democrats being any kind of alternative to the policies of, say, Trump or whatever. So DACA is this big sort of, you know, teachable moment, as they used to say, under the Obama administration, that I think people are abandoning the Democratic Party. I know of at least one high-profile activist who publicly, when the Democrats caved on DACA, even before Pelosi's speech, said that she was done. She's a well-known activist, immigrant rights activist. And she put her, she allowed the movement for a People's Party, which used to be Millennials for Sanders, to use her information and her statement about leaving the Democrats. So in this article, a big back page article in the February issue of Socialist Alternative, there's this part I want to read real quick, Against Our Common Enemy. I think it's by Shama Sawant wrote this part. Or at least they're quoting her. She said, why should U.S.-born workers care to defend their immigrant neighbors and co-workers against ICE and the Trump deportation machine and join the fight for citizenship rights for all immigrants? ICE Director Thomas Homan recently proclaimed, quote, ICE will continue its efforts to protect jobs for American workers by limiting unfair competitive advantage. It's for companies that exploit illegal immigration. That's from NBC 11018. Now, the answer is, this is pure demagogy. But is the exact argument made by the anti-immigrant right. As Shama Sawant, Seattle City Councilor and Social Alternative member, stated last May, quote, millions of refugees and other immigrants who have fled to the U.S. prefer not to have left their home countries. They are not just refugees of war, but also of economic devastation, inflicted by capitalism's drive to make working people, the poor, and youth pay for a crisis that this system created. Budget-cutting austerity programs have gutted social services and privatized former public institutions, while the recovery, quote-unquote, from the global economic crisis has been shallow and mainly benefited the super wealthy around the world. These are the conditions which lead people to flee their homes, and the U.S. billionaire class is all too often responsible for the policies leading to that devastation. Unlike Trump, many of his big business friends are in favor of immigration, as long as they can hold down immigrants as second-class citizens who face the constant threat of deportation. Marginalizing sections of the workforce helps big business to drive down wages for everyone. This situation also helps them carry out a divide-and-rule policy because it can lead to some workers born in the U.S. feeling resentful and fearful of lower wages and unemployment. We need to understand, though, that the situation is created by the billionaires and politicians, not the immigrant workers. If all workers living in the U.S. were granted full legal and citizenship rights, in other words, an amnesty, then it would make it harder for employers to use fear or drive down wages and benefits. With the threat of deportation lifted, all workers would be stronger together in demanding better jobs, social services, and democratic rights. So I really liked that part. Thought it was really good. It keeps coming up over and over again. And yet the latest is DACA has been abandoned. We have a whole leaflet on that. I'm not going to have time to get into. By the way, the last show we talked about the Me Too, movement, the movement against sexual harassment, against especially in the workplace, but I think a more generalized sort of resurgence of the feminist movement. We had public meetings around the country on socialist feminism and the worldwide women's struggle and Me Too and the new women's movement. We had advertised some public meetings happening in Worcester. They got snowed out. That one day it snowed was when our meetings were. You remember that Wednesday?
Yeah.
So that was unfortunate. We're going to reschedule, by the way, anyone that is listening out there by computer or whatever. And we will reschedule those, and we'll get more into that issue next time. I want to finish, because we're running out of time, with another kind of myth buster here. Two of them, if we have time. And I don't know if you saw this anywhere, Diego. This is pretty cool. You know Mother Jones magazine, right? Kind of liberal left, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, quote from Mother Jones, February 9th, 2018, quote, an article entitled, "The economic outlook for millennials is bleak. Now they're unionizing in record numbers." I had no idea. This is really interesting information. 76% of the increase in union membership in 2017 was workers under 35. Now, there was a small increase in union membership in 2017, by the way. Wasn't enough, but it was a small increase. And then of that, 76% were workers under 35. That's unusual because historically, at least in the 1950s on, the labor segment, the unionized segment of the population have been aging, and there not enough young workers were part of unions. So here we go. The total number of union members grew by 262,000 in 2017. Again, way too low, but it's something. It's a gain at least. 3/4 of those gains were among workers under 35. So young Americans are rediscovering unions. According to the Economic Policy Institute, a liberal think tank, 76% of new union members in 2013 were younger than 35. That's pretty significant considering the workers, that workers 34 and under make up just 40% of the country's total workforce. In short, young workers may be kicking off a trend, this is what we hope, that will strengthen a labor movement that's been brought to its knees by decades of attacks from employers, corporations, and hostile lawmakers. These numbers represent a significant break with recent history. Younger workers have always been less likely than older ones to be unionized. This is still the case with roughly 8% of workers under 34 are in unions, compared with 13% of workers 35 and older. Yet, nearly 1 in 4 new jobs among young workers in 2013 was a union job. Recent polling suggests that today's young workers increasingly identify with organized labor. Last year, Pew Research found 75%, listen to this, 75% of 18 to 29-year-olds, including 55% of young Republicans, even them, 55% of young Republicans have favorable views of unions, a rate far higher than that of any other age group. And then in the same article, jumping down, this is very interesting, quote, the economic outlook is bleak for many young people who have lower incomes, higher debts, and virtually no wealth to speak of, according to the People's Policy Project, a progressive think tank. It's against this backdrop that they've formed increasingly progressive views. And here's one you have to listen to. We've had on the show before. They've formed increasingly progressive views. In one survey, 18 to 29-year-olds gave socialism a higher favorability rate than capitalism. In one survey, 18 to 29-year-olds gave socialism a slightly higher favorability rating than capitalism. Younger workers have turned to unions to find some security that the free market, so-called, alone, that labor market, unions to find security that the free market alone, that the labor market alone fails to provide. Unionization from better wages to better benefits provides a degree of economic security that we just don't have in the U.S. economy. And there's plenty of graphs and so on that show that chart of decline in union membership is just also right there with decline in wages and decline in benefits and so on. It's just totally linked, unfortunately. Tomorrow, around the country, including in Boston, mostly in the South, but in Boston at somewhere in Dorchester, I think. Where did it go? I thought I had it on here. There's going to be a lot of $15 an hour minimum wage protests and maybe some walkouts of workplaces. And they're doing it on the anniversary of the Memphis workers' strike, or near that anniversary. And also they're doing it for the Poor People's Campaign, trying to raise, talk about that. But they're mainly doing it for $50 minimum wage. Look out for those. Also, we have March 8th, International Women's Day, coming up. So if this Me Too movement and related aspects of it keep going, there should be more things happening on that. On February 26th, here in Massachusetts, the unions are going to be out in many different cities protesting against this law coming down on the Supreme Court that will outlaw automatic collection of dues for public sector workers and do other things along sort of the right to work attack laws on unions. Perhaps last but not least, because of time, did you hear about the privatized rocket that went up to space?
No.
You didn't? Okay, so, this was all over the place.
So now okay. There's a person that has a rocket.
Elon Musk. Did you ever hear that name?
No.
It's capitalist pig. He's in charge of, he's the CEO of Tesla. Tesla making those cars, electric cars and stuff. So Elon Musk of Tesla also has a side gig running a corporation called something that is doing space. What the heck is the name of this space company? They're doing privatized business space exploration. And what I've got 2 points about that. Sorry, go ahead.
I hope some aliens literally snatch them up and say, bring them back to reality. Well, you're invading my space.
I'm surprised you missed the press on that or the media on that, because they were saying a lot of different things. One was that it was so successful, the launch, and it's for a deep space, supposedly, or deeper space exploration. And they were all excited about it. It actually didn't blow up when it took off because some of those private things do. And then it was this wave of talking to the so-called pundits, the so-called knowledgeable media types and others, academics and so on. So what do you think? Does private initiatives in space, is this a helpful or a hindrance? And all the people I heard that were asked that say, oh, I think it's helpful. I think it's great. Really, really great. And I didn't hear any acknowledgement that NASA has been cut. They just would say things like NASA, budget for NASA. They just say NASA doesn't do this or that anymore. NASA being the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. So I found this coverage extremely, of course, as usual, corporate media, one-sided, because they were all like, oh, yeah, this private thing is great. And I immediately thought of about 5 million reasons why it's bad, you know? One is space itself. Right now, there as the U.S., as the world is sort of crawling into space, there are already attempts to define areas by national state, you know, and say we have an interest in that. And this, yeah, that's going to get worse probably. To add the corporations to that
will be horrible. Now I want the aliens to come here and be like, put us in, hey, well, the aliens who do you probably, think you're going to invade us?
Yeah.
We can invade you.
Yeah. And also, what's wrong about this is the lack of accountability of a private corporation doing that. At least when NASA does it, there's some sort of, you know, you could elect people close to NASA, maybe. You could put political pressure on that would have much more effect on a government entity and on the policies they do versus Elon Musk's secretive thing here.
So the International Space Program's out the door.
They're focusing, supposedly they're going to focus on going to the moon again. But there's also this attention to Mars, but in terms of like funding and actually building these long range rockets and so on, that's not happening yet. It's out the door pretty much, as far as I understand it. But then this guy, Elon Musk, takes this publicity from the rocket launch and throws this out, this anti-union attack this anti-union attack because the workers in his factory, Tesla factory in California, in Fremont, California, want to actually organize a union. They want to be part of the United Auto Workers. And he writes this whole thing that's so horrible. And what's that horrible, you know, how horrible is they want to organize. So what he promises them instead, among other things, is they're going to have like frozen yogurt stands around the factory. I'm serious. Oh, I'm serious,
I need.
Man.
I need a lot of yogurt. They're gonna union, but we need yogurt.
They're going to have a big party. They're going to have a transportation thing that will be like a roller coaster. And I don't know, they quote here a company with over 30,000 employees. I don't know how many are just in the manufacturing. They've opened up a third shift, hired thousands of people supposedly, but they have all these problems actually working there. Forced overtime, it looks like, things like that. And so people are trying hard to unionize there, and I hope it succeeds. Early days yet, it looks like. So Elon Musk, yes, there are a lot of problems. I didn't even get into a lot of them, of private space exploration, and there are certainly a lot of problems with you know, this guy using this notoriety that he has or fame to then try to brainwash his workers against unionizing. So we're pretty much out of time. You've been listening to Socialist Alternative Radio. We didn't get to Eugene Debs. I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. We'll do it next time.
And what is that book again?
It's called Eugene Debs Speaks. It's basically kind of like all the speeches. Yeah. And
Eugene Debs, by the way, was the socialist,
candidate
for president many times, but two times from prison.
And he was against the Great War, the First World War.
And he won.
He was arrested.
A high vote at the time from prison.
He was kept under arrest. So,
leader of the Socialist Party.
He's there with us.
Mass party at one point.
He suffered
in the
with the rest of us.
Yeah. We're going to go out with a song by Gil Scott-Heron called Save the Children. And we'll be back in 2 weeks. You're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio. And you are listening to WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford.